You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Kathy Akers. Kathy, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So let's talk about what's happening now. You're in California at the moment. Is that correct?
Yes, I have been in California for about 15 years now. I'm originally from Maryland, and I went to school in Boston. Then I spent a little bit of time in New York before coming out here about 2000.
And so tell me a little bit about, maybe we should just start there and kind of move through what happened. So then you came to California for CalArts. Is that why you came out?
Well, actually, I came out before I went to CalArts because my partner got into a grad school out here. He's a filmmaker. And so he got into the American Film Institute and came out here. But I'd always wanted to live in California. It was kind of it seemed like a great place to be because everybody I met on the East Coast who was from California was really interesting. So I'd always imagined I'd end up in the San Francisco area, but I ended up in L.A., and it's kind of been great because I have been able to see the art scene, or at least the commercial art scene in L.A., you know, transform during the past 15 years, which has been interesting. But after I was out here for about 4 years, I went to CalArts for photography and media for graduate school. And that was a transformational experience. I went into the school being pretty much solely a photographer, and I came out of the school making dioramas and sculptures and video installations. So it was really a broadening experience for my practice. I felt like I didn't have to be an artist that works with one medium or have one sort of type of work that I make. I could make any kind of work that felt like it was serving the interest of my concerns. So that was really a wonderful thing.
That is a wonderful thing, and does sound transformational. So what happened when you got out? Maybe let's talk about where you took your work from there, or what kind of work were you making when you got out of school, and what was next?
Well, when I got out, I was really involved in making these really detailed, really large dioramas. I had invented this imaginary world that I called Hurtopia, and it was basically a world that was populated only by women. And I was really interested in what makes a society, you know, what people need in order to create communities and, you know, have some sort of sense of belonging, but also be productive and, you know, what is essential for society, sort of starting from the ground up. So I envisioned these women as being kind of without society, and they were slowly starting to invent the rules that their community would live by. So they were pretty feral. I was interested in exploring the notion of women and nature, and I'd heard a lot from older women that, you know, if society was, you know, female only, there would be no conflict and everything would be wonderful. But in Hurtopia, in this imaginary land I proposed, things were still pretty, my concept was that human nature is human nature, if it's women or if it's men. So these women, you know, get in fights with each other, they have conflicts, they have an interesting relationship with nature, because they actually have sex with coyotes and produce half human, half coyote children. And so it's kind of this wild world where they're kind of figuring out what their rules are, but they're acting in kind of a lawless way. So that was really fun. And I made three dioramas in that series. and they all kind of related to my interest in photography as well, because the first one was a large room with a diorama in the middle, and it had these monocular lenses embedded in the walls, so you had to look through a lens to see the diorama, because the walls around the diorama were complete. You couldn't see through them in any way except through looking through the lenses. And the lenses, because they enlarged what was inside the room, the dioramas looked like you weren't sure what scale it was. So that was interesting to me. And then the second diorama in that series was I built a round structure. It was basically a giant cylinder around the diorama with a viewing window kind of at eye level that presented a 360-degree view of this landscape with the women inside, you know, interacting with each other and with the coyotes. So the viewer could walk around it but only see through this, you know, thin sliver of clear plastic. And then for the third diorama in the series, I wanted to change the viewer's perspective yet again of the dioramas by hanging the diorama on a wall inside a box and cutting a hole in the center of the diorama. So the viewer would actually have to walk up a series of small steps and then put their head in the middle of the diorama, and they could turn around 360 degrees and be surrounded by the diorama itself. So I think I was really interested in using sort of this installation sculptural form to determine how the viewer interacted with the pieces, kind of the way, you know, looking through a camera's lens determines your perception of the world.
And that is pretty exciting, and that's forming a whole way of working. And so at this point, just to keep the timeline clear, you're out of school, and you're making these kind of immersive installations that are based on really a specific set of ideas. What was the reaction like to that? Because those ideas about what you're talking about, a kind of different type of community or way of thinking, are pretty provocative ideas, right?
Yeah, well, it was kind of great because I felt like I got a really good response to the work. I showed it in like two different venues, and then a great curator named Emma Gray saw the work at one of the shows, and she introduced me to Honor Fraser, who has a gallery here in Los Angeles, and I was able to actually show all three of these diorama installations in one space in her gallery, which was super great because it kind of showed the evolution of the idea and the project. So that was really great. But it was kind of, as far as like timing goes, it wasn't the best timing because that was early in 2008. And so I think there was a lot of optimism that big work like that would be marketable at that point, but then the whole recession happened. And I think the, you know, collectors got a lot more conservative as to what they wanted to invest in. So that was maybe not the best moment. So
Just to be clear, we're talking about 2008, 2007, yep. 8, 9, something like that? Right, okay.
Yeah, so I showed in early 2008, and by late 2008, things were slowing down a lot. So I decided to recalibrate. I had a good momentum for like the first year or two out of grad school, and then I decided that basically, I needed to get more of a day job. So I did that. And I've been working at CalArts, or I started work at CalArts in like 2007 as a grant writer. And that was a really interesting job to have. But I started to scale back the work a bit, just because making big work like that was not really It was very labor and time intensive, and I needed to do something that was a little more modest. So I started working on these. I started getting interested as an outshoot of this work in like sort of the modern day version of people trying to initiate their own communities and figure out, you know, what their rules would be. And so that, the natural, you know, correlation in the real world of that would be communes. And I started to investigate communes, specifically ones that were started in the 1960s, because that was such a huge period of, like, interest in communes and energy behind that kind of thinking, that you could create something totally from scratch, and it would be a better way to live than in mainstream society. So I started researching communes online, and I found this amazing commune that no longer exists, but was formed in about 1964 called Morningstar. And it was up in Sonoma County, and it was kind of exactly the modern correlation to my idea of Hurtopia, because basically it was a no-rules kind of commune where anybody could come and do whatever they wanted. And it was a plot of land owned by this sort of famous folk musician who had decided to give up his career and just buy this large plot of land and invite anybody who wanted to come to stay on it. And
who was that folk musician?
His name was Lou Gottlieb, and he was a member of this sort of folk pop group, the Limelighters. And they were famous, like, in the early 60s. And so I think he made, he had a good living, and he just wanted to kind of drop out of the music world and sort of the tough, you know, on-the-road life and focus on what was more interesting to him, which was, you know, engaging in these sort of social experiments, inviting everybody to come and live on his land. And one of the commune members had developed this really extensive online archive of photographs and interviews with people who lived at the communes. And it was this really amazing resource. And I kind of dove right into it. And it's all these stories sparked my imagination about the crazy, you know, the good and the bad things that can happen when there's no rules, like, because only your needs and desires sort of dictate what happens. So there was really scary things that happened, and there was really wonderful things that happened. I researched that for a while. I started making pictures, collaged photographs that incorporated some photographs I had taken from some communes a few years before that, and put the historical pictures of people at Morningstar on top of that, sort of combining the present and the past and thinking about the legacy of these communes that were no longer like as vibrant as they once were, but were still going. So I did that for a while, and then I actually got in touch with Ramon Sender, who was and is the archivist for Morningstar Commune, and he actually turns out to be this really accomplished guy who's a novelist, and he was one of the pioneers of like the early like tape loop new music movement up in San Francisco in the early 60s. And so I went up and met him in San Francisco, and we started this conversation about communes and communities and creating your own society and kind of what the role of Morningstar was at that time and sort of mid to late 60s society, and he was a really wonderful resource, and he started inviting me to these reunions that the commune former residents would have every May 1st for May Day up at some land that was still owned by one of the former commune members, and it was really amazing to go to that, and it was kind of like a flashback to the 60s, although everybody was in their, you know, 60s or 70s or even 80s. But it was a really wonderful resource, and people brought their children and their grandchildren. So it was kind of like seeing the continuity of that community carry on. So that got me really interested in hearing more about the history of those communes. And Ramon actually was so generous as to let me borrow a whole lot of audio tapes that he had recorded in the 70s after the commune had disbanded. It only lasted till about 1971 because of conflicts with the neighbors that were nearby. And so there are these great audio tapes that he made, and I produced some audio pieces using the footage in those tapes, and also some large-scale collaged photographs that I showed at Emma Gray, the curator, actually opened her own gallery for a while in Culver City, California, called Emma Gray Headquarters. And I had a show there of that work, the large collage photographs and the audio pieces, in 2011. And based on that work, I actually applied to a grant from my undergraduate institution, which is the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And they have this wonderful, wonderful grant that's only open to alumni, which is a travel grant. And they have this endowment that was established like 100 years ago that funds this. And so I applied to go to other communes around the country that were still operating, that were founded in the 60s, and do research and take photographs and kind of compare and contrast different styles of communities. And it was wonderful. I got that grant, and in the summer of 2012, I visited about four communes. There was Black Bear Ranch in Northern California, Alpha Farm in Oregon, The Farm in Tennessee, and Twin Oaks in Virginia. And based upon that experience, I produced yet another series of collage photographs, this time actually collaging together photographs from each community with historical photographs from each community. So they were more closely tied together into the history of each individual community. And I started to think about how I could create more depth and more interest in them. So I started creating multi-level, like 3D collages, where there's different panes of plexiglass with different images on each pane. And so it creates an illusion of depth and I think greater complexity to the images. In some of them, there's like 3 layers of pictures. So you can see like the past and the present of each place at the same time. So that is a technique I worked on for probably 2 years, trying to figure out how to make that work. And
but by trying to mean how to make it work, you mean how to, so you've done this, This grant is over, and
right.
You mean by making it work, how to put that together in terms of visual work?
At time, yeah, I think it was a little, you know, dealing with the multiple layers of images and figuring out how to, it's kind of, I think one of the things I've run into that's difficult about working with communities that still exist is that you want to be, or at least I felt this when I was making this particular body of work, that you want to be respectful of the community and sort of honor their history through these photo collages, but you don't want to be, you know, so glowing that you're not critical at all. So I felt like I was walking this fine line to being like really kind of honoring the history of it, but kind of alluding to the fact that they're mostly depopulated now. I mean, there's some people left, but the energy of that time is gone. But there's still some things that carry on, but it's just kind of, they're shadows of their former self. And it's, you know, time has moved on. So it's kind of a bittersweet thing. So I wanted to call attention to that a little bit.
So it sounds really, you know, exciting that you went through that whole process of looking at all of these other, you know, forms that are out there, and some that, you, as you were saying, you're walking a fine line between being critical and not being critical. But that's a powerful issue and an idea that I just want to discuss a little more. As you were as you were looking at all of these, you know, we're talking about, in a sense, failed utopias or compromised utopias or something like that.
Right. Yeah, totally.
What did you see happening? I mean, honestly, was it what was working in these systems, do you think, or what wasn't working?
Yeah, I mean, it was very community specific, I would have to say, because they were all established with a very different, ground rules or ideas that were shared through the community. I think, you know, it's a little bit different now than it was back in the 60s, in that I think the people who participate in these communities who are young, who are people in their 20s or 30s, like, have a different idea of the function they serve. I think in the 60s, the people who founded these communes thought that, okay, we're establishing these communities. This is going to be a real alternative to, the mainstream way of life. And these communities are going to basically establish a whole new way of being. And we are going to live in them for the rest of our lives. And actually, us establishing these communities and establishing this model will influence the entire world, and the whole world will change, and it's going to be amazing. So there was this really, I think, innocent sense of optimism that really, you know, these people were the driving force behind, like, world change. And I think now people, you know, obviously 40 years later, people realize that didn't really happen, and it didn't really change the world in the way that people thought it would. Maybe it changed the world in more subtle ways. So I think the people who gravitate to the communes now are very much there for, like, a brief experience, kind of like, okay, I'm going to go for the summer, I'm going to have this great experience, and then I'm going to move on with the rest of my life. So it's a lot more of a temporary feeling, I think, at many of these places where people kind of pass through in a regular rotation. So almost like a very immersive summer camp or something like that. And I just think there's a different level of commitment on the people who are there, and having this be like a long-term, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life type thing.
Right.
Although in some places, I mean, some of the places where they had such a really cohesive group that maybe had a leader who was really strong, that had a definitive philosophy that people really bought into in the 60s. Like, I would say the farm in Tennessee is one of those, where they had this leader named Stephen Gaskin, who was a really popular teacher in the 60s in San Francisco, and brought a lot of his followers to Tennessee to start a huge farm, where they tried to be self-sufficient and grow all their own food and have all their own sort of internal structures where they didn't have to go to the outside world for anything. And he had a very definitive, like, philosophy of life. And I think because of that, that really defined vision, a lot of the people who settled in the farm back in the 60s are still there. You know, they have made a lifelong commitment to being there. And, you know, many of them have stayed on. I would say probably at least 100 of them are still there and have been there and never been anyplace else for 40 years. So that commitment is really impressive. But at the same time, it's interesting because they have such really strict requirements for people who are going to join the community now, that it actually makes it almost impossible for new young people to join. And many people that grew up on the farm and want to go back and want to be close to their parents now that they have kids or families of their own, move just outside the farm gates, so they can be close, but they don't have to follow all the very strict rules of the farm. So it's kind of because of the strictness of the rules they've established for new members joining, it's kind of really limiting the future appeal of it to other people. But in other places, I mean, that's one extreme where people are super committed. But the
And I imagine, that makes me think of an extreme like, and I don't know if it is that extreme, but Arcasanti is also kind of
right.
an experimental.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, quasi-dictatorial or, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about the farm is that they started a little bit late. They didn't start until about 71. And they were totally sharing all their finances and, you know, just functioning as a unit until probably, I think, 82 or 83, when it just, you know, the physical living conditions got just too poor for people, and their kids started growing up, and they wanted to be able to have the freedom to, like, you know, buy their kids' shoes without having to go through the commune bank and all that stuff, because they just were living in real poverty for all that time. So they basically rebelled and said, no, we don't want to live as a commune anymore. We want to have our own separate finances, and we'll own the land together, but we want to have more independence. And so at that point, the leadership of Stephen Gaskin was not as complete as it once was. So it was a commune that actually survived that transformation, which is very interesting. I mean, most communes would fall apart at that point, but they kept on going, just in a slightly altered form.
And so after that, which, I mean, that's not after that, but then, so you this is so much a part of what you're learning and understanding more about.
Right.
There was a few different shows after that, but then what happened, or what's happening now? Now we're getting into like 2013 or something.
Right. Well, what's happening now is I've discovered ceramics, which is unexpected, but great. I mean, I think after doing photography for so long and not really being able to make those extensive dioramas that I once made because of the kind of the time required, they're so labor intensive. I wanted to do something that was kind of fast and very tactile, very hands-on, and very immediate. So clay fulfilled all those requirements. And I'm still in the process now of figuring out exactly what my direction is with the ceramics, but I've started experimenting with putting images from the communes on ceramics through silk screening on them, or doing photocopy transfers of the images onto the ceramic. And I love the combination of these like physical objects and the images. So I'm trying to work out exactly how to make something that I consider like a finished work in this medium. But I've only really been doing ceramics for like a year, so I'm still in the process of figuring out how it can work with like the specific sort of commune project and how it can further my investigation that I started with the collaged photographs.
So then tell me, what are you actually working on now then? I mean, that's such an interesting point. So there's the ceramics and there's the photography, and I mean, in one sense, yeah, I want to hear maybe just what you're making or working on next.
Mm-hmm.
But also that's such powerful research you went through. You weren't making a variety of objects or installations only. They all centered around this kind of very particular and peculiar theme of kind of independent utopias or communes. So in terms of what you're making next and the experiments with ceramics, where you left kind of in terms of the research, like what do you think about all of these? Because though they were failed experiments of all different kinds, I mean, and some maybe not so much, like the one you mentioned, kind of moving over into changing its format somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, if it's not too open a question, what does that make you think about how people are dealing with potentially utopias?
I guess the next step for me is what I really would like to do during the next year is go back to my two communes that I thought were the most interesting, and partially because they were the most extreme in how they chose to organize themselves. And so I'm planning this summer on going back to Black Bear Ranch in Northern California, which is basically a commune that has decided from its very beginning it would have no rules. And it's kind of a anarchy situation where people can come and do what they want. And it's kind of interesting. Sometimes it can be a little intimidating and scary, depending on who's there. When I went last time, it was a little, some of the people were a little non-friendly and paranoid about me being some sort of, I don't know, person who was going to expose them to, like, quote-unquote, the man. And I don't know. They were very paranoid. So, but it was one of the most beautiful places on Earth I've ever been. It's up in the mountains, very close to the Oregon border, and literally 2 hours from the closest town. And it's just really beautiful. It was used to be a mining camp in the 1800s, and it's just really great. But I'd like to go back there this summer and see, you know, I'm sure there's, you know, pretty much a new crop of people there because their turnover is pretty high, and see if it is totally different now based upon the new people being there, or if there's some continuity in just the philosophy of the place that carries over no matter who's there. And another reason why I want to go back is because one of the things that's really special about that commune is they have an amazing archive on site of all the books, all the photographs, everything that's been produced since it was founded, in this giant wall of books and photographs that I only just looked at very briefly when I was there last time. There's a whole portfolio stuffed in with all these falling apart books of photographs made by Jock Sturges, I think in the 90s sometime, that are just these beautiful 8x10 contact prints. And I was just shocked to find them there, and I was wondering what else.
Wow, that was it. Jock Sturges did like nude portraits of families,
yes,
right?
Yes, nude portraits of families by the pond there. So that's a whole another interesting component to that place, is just their archive. But so I'd like to go back and actually do some video work that I started when I was there in 2012, but I don't think I had a quite clear enough idea of what I was trying to accomplish. But this time I'd like to go back with the right equipment, and hopefully the people will be more amenable to me taking images of them, because they were kind of hostile last time. And I would really
right,
like
which is an interesting territory to kind of, I mean, as a photographer too, an artist, that's interesting. Issue to overcome is the reluctance of people wanting to be photographed, I would think.
Yeah, especially people, I mean, people go there because it is so far away from everything, and, you know, they kind of hide out there from, I feel, a little bit from real life, and just are kind of on this endless vacation, but are also, combined with that, kind of paranoid.
Right.
So it's an interesting combination. But I'd like to go back and do, I mean, I feel like it's a very photographer thing to do, but take videos that are kind of like moving photographs, you know, where the camera is static and you just kind of record people doing things in the landscape, or just the landscape itself. Or I kind of have this idea of doing like Andy Warhol type screen tests with the residents, where I just take 10 minutes footage of them, you know, hanging out, being themselves. I kind of, my goal for this is kind of to get a sense of what it's like to, like, be in this place, in this space, and somehow communicate that to viewers through this kind of time-based, I don't know, experiential capturing of the place. I really like the work of Sharon Lockhart, who's done a lot of films that are very you know, where the camera's very still and it's like very observational. And I think that's an interesting tack for me to take when I go back.
That is. And so in closing, it's exciting to hear about what you've been through and what you're continuing to research and how that informs your work. Is there anywhere you want to point the listeners to? People are listening to this from different parts of the world, California and the East Coast as well as Europe, but is there anywhere they'll see the links to your website on the
right.
on the interview, but is there any other where anywhere else you will be showing work in the future or want to point people to for any reason?
Well, I mean, I might want to point people, I can send you the links, but to actually the website that started all of this, which was the archives of the Morningstar Commune. So if people are interested in looking at that, I can certainly give them the link to that.
That sounds great. And as far as upcoming shows for you, do you imagine there'll be some this year in California?
Well, I'm waiting on a show in Belgium that has been postponed many times. That is an international show about actually pee in art. I have done a series of photographs that we haven't talked about in this interview, but they're called pee performances. And
right,
they
so
are,
let's end up with that. I know those images too, right? The images of you peeing outside,
yep,
right?
Yep, that's me
correct?
Peeing in the landscape, yep. I'm communing with nature. So that's, I mean, I don't know if that show is going to happen, but that was maybe going to happen in Brussels, and we'll see if that happens maybe in the spring. I'm also going to be a part of a group show in Glendale at this beautiful art gallery and library called the Brand Art Gallery in August and September of 2016. So
that's
I'm
interesting because the pee performance is in a way, in the context of everything we're talking about, sounds I mean, you mentioned the term communing with nature, but
mm-hmm.
isn't that kind of what all these communities are doing that you're visiting in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in how people negotiate their relationship with nature and how they attempt to become one with nature, although I believe that's impossible. But, you know, the gestures people make, I think, is very interesting.
I think so, too. And you continue to write grants and are still doing that?
Yes, I am. I actually, one of my favorite things I do at CalArts is I, about twice a year, I have a lecture that I do for students on how to find funding for their projects. And that's a super fun thing for me to do to help people, you know, find resources out there to help their art, you know, keep going after they graduate from school.
Well, that's a great thing to discuss, and well, we could spend a whole talk on that. I'm really glad you're doing that, and perhaps some of the resources that you're discussing with your students, we could link to. Are there specific ones where you tell people to look for grants in particular?
Well, I mean, I have a link. I have basically a document that has like all the databases you can look in, like the clearinghouses for listings for grants. But I also talk a lot about strategies and, you know, how you should kind of think about getting money for your grants and think strategically about it and think in a very different way than you would, you know, just as an artist making your art. So it's kind of a philosophy, and it's also kind of providing them with, you know, a broad base of resources where they can do further research.
Well, I like that. I think it's great that you're doing that, and I'll of course include some information about that. Kathy,
great.
Thanks so much for talking with me today. It's been great talking with you, and I love hearing about your process and your work.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really fun.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.